Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, have I got a smashing guest for you today? I'm very excited. He lives in California. He's a wonderful musician and composer. He's also really funny. And he was in a little band called The Police. He is the drummer, Stuart Copeland. And just so you know, some of his language is very flowery, so to speak, and a bit exuberant. So if you take offence in strong language, maybe you shouldn't listen, but he's brilliant. I hope you enjoy. Stuart, hello. How are you?
Hello, Twiggy. It's a long time since we last met at someone's, I don't know whose wedding it was, but there we were nattering away while some young people were getting wed.
I was trying to think where it was. I can't, but it was a long time ago.
I think it was
ago.
The Eves.
Oh, it might be one of the kids.
Yeah.
It wasn't Sharon.
I'm sure they've all got children by now.
One has a little baby boy.
Really?
Yeah, Jack has got. Jack has got a little baby boy.
Excellent. Okay.
Anyway, you are in California, right?
Yeah, I'm in California where the sun is shining. And where are you, in England?
It's bloody freezing. The weather has changed.
Excellent.
It's pouring with rain. And
Excellent.
You're in sunny California.
And you probably haven't seen the sun in 2 months. I lived in England for 20 years, so that's why I am enjoying your discomfort so profoundly.
The only good thing about it, I can get all my lovely woolly jumpers and my furry boots out. I love all the clothes that you can wear in the winter, but I do miss...
Well, Fiona calls it hat weather.
Yes, it is. Yeah, because your wife...
She can wear her hats.
For people who don't know, your wife is called Fiona, and she's English, correct?
Yes. I married up.
But aren't you, your mum, I read in your biog, it was Scottish.
That's right.
So you are
and
half.
And my father's family.
You are half British.
Half teabag. Yeah. And I spent 20 years there, so I probably got more teabag in me than I care to admit. But I go to Scotland because my father's family, the Copelands, apparently are from Scotland.
Oh, are and they?
Yeah, but when I go up to Edinburgh or Glasgow, the people don't look like me. But then when I go over to Norway, they do look like me.
Oh, yes.
And my first thought is, let's go hit Scotland.
Have you ever done, DNA and all that? You know, you can send it off and... Because maybe you're Scandinavian.
Well, I'm 99.8% Northern European.
Oh, well, there you go.
How can I possibly be so funky? It's not natural.
But whereabouts in Scotland was your mum born?
Leith.
Oh, in Leith, okay.
But she met my daddy during the war, who was an intelligence. She was an intelligence as well. She was an SOE, which is these ladies who analyzed all the German communications and all the train times. And she was one of the ladies who figured out the program of where to bomb and when and which train lines to attack.
Oh, wow. Is that what they did at Bletchley Park, or was that different?
That's right.
Oh, was she there?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
After the war, she discovered archaeology and had four kids. My daddy continued on as a spy with the OSS, which became the CIA.
I was going to ask you that because I read that your dad, he helped form the CIA.
He was there in the beginning, yes. He was one of the founding members of this illustrious organization.
When you grew up, you knew he was with the CIA, but did he? Oh, you didn't?
No.
It was all secret.
My brother did come. Oh, yeah. My brother did come home from school one day and said, Dad... Are you a spy? To which our father responded, and as you can imagine, this is a family legend, he responded, "Who wants to know?"
Brilliant.
But then again, in Beirut, in Beirut, Lebanon, at that time, it was sort of the nexus of all intrigue in the Middle East. And everybody's daddy was a spy. Isn't yours?
No, my dad wasn't, I'm afraid.
No.
So were you living in Beirut then?
Yes. I left America when I was 2 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And went to, my daddy was away on business installing a dictator named of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt.
Yeah.
Who actually turned out to be a very benign dictator and did a lot of really good work for, you know, for his country. And we moved, so I was sent off, packed off to Cairo at the age of 2 months. And from there to Beirut, Lebanon, until I was a teenager, where I was sent off to darkest Somerset boarding school.
Oh.
And then ended up as a angry young man in London. And basically, I lived in England for 20 years.
But when you were in, so you went to, your primary school was in Beirut.
Yeah, elementary school, we call it. The American Community School.
I mean, you must have really missed Beirut when they shipped you off to wet, cold England, yeah?
Well, yes and no. England had television. And what I noticed, first of all, was that half my vocabulary wasn't English. You know, in England, in Beirut, everyone spoke Araba Franglais, which is a combination of Arabic, French, and English. And so I didn't even realize that half the words that I was using were not English. They were Arabic.
Wow.
That took a minute to get around.
That's amazing. So did you, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had two brothers and one sister.
Okay, and did they all go to school in Beirut?
Yes, I was the youngest.
Oh, okay.
And by the time I went off the board, they had all grown up and out.
Oh, okay.
And so I was the last one down in Somerset.
In Millfield, was it Millfield?
Millfield.
Yeah, Millfield. Quite a famous
within
school.
Within sight of Glastonbury Tor.
Ooh. Very nice.
Yeah. And now, and I never played the Glastonbury Festival, and I understand that the Glastonbury Festival actually isn't in Glastonbury, which is a travesty.
No, it's not.
But I know that region very well.
It's beautiful, actually. It is gorgeous. So why haven't you got a kind of English, Frenchy, Arabic-y accent? You've got a very American accent.
I work on it.
But you went to...
Well, nothing, there's no accent more annoying than that transatlantic kind of half English, half American. So all my life I've been American. God damn it, I'm American.
You're American, I'm proud
school,
of it.
American. Well, because in those days, America was the shining light on the hill.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in Beirut, in the Middle East in that time, believe it or not, America was very highly regarded. All those other imperial monsters such as England,
Great Britain,
were all held in great suspicion by the what was then called the Third World, which just meant that they weren't on our side or their side, they were on their own side. They regarded the previous empires with deep suspicion, but the Americans were fresh and new and were building hospitals and universities and good stuff. And didn't have any kind of baggage or past. Of course, my father, with his skullduggery, was inventing some new baggage, which we are now paying the cost of today.
Oh, really? Did he tell you anything about what he was doing, or did you think he was...
Eventually.
Oh, he did?
Eventually. I was in college.
In America, right? You went to college in America.
In America.
Yeah, okay.
By this time, I'm in California. And he wrote a book. And on the liner notes of my daddy's book, Miles Copeland, CIA spy! Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, wow.
I sort of already knew that, but like I was saying earlier, everybody's daddy is a spy in Beirut. and so it wasn't... And by the way, one of my best friends in Beirut was an English kid named of Harry Philby. His daddy was a spy.
Was a spy. Oh, my goodness.
And one day, his father disappeared. And there was a big hoo-ha all over, you know, social Beirut.
Yeah.
The English-speaking society of Beirut. It was a big hoo-ha. Us children didn't really know what it was about. I was probably 14, 15 at the time. And Harry, their family stayed at our house. We were just outside of town. And we're holed up there. We were parallel families. We kind of had similarly aged children. And Kim Philby and my dad were best buddies.
Wow.
And he was absolutely devastated when he turned into it turned out he was a double agent.
Yeah.
And in later years, I tried to find Harry, but he doesn't exist on the Google machine, and I just can't find him. Eventually, it turns out he has a niece who is a journalist.
Uh-huh.
And I found her and made a connection with her. And I was so pleased to make the connection that I wrote a sort of a jocular letter saying, gosh, oh dear, what our scoundrel fathers, you know, laugh, what a forgetting entirely. Most insensitive that, of course, it's a big laugh on our side. My father wasn't a double agent. The Philby family must have been utterly destroyed by what their father did. I mean, you know, Harry must have been kicked out of his boarding school and back in England.
Yeah.
The whole family, you know, and their sense of humor on this topic is probably constrained.
So, when did you... So there's no musicians in that part of your family?
Oh, yeah. Well, my father was a musician.
Oh, he was. Oh, okay.
He was a jazz musician.
Because when I talk to people, it's amazing how, especially if they're musicians or singers, that somewhere down the line, there is somebody who did it even as an amateur.
There's somebody in the fuel supply, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in my case, it was my father, who was a jazz musician before the war, and I still got his trumpet. I'm looking at it right over there.
How lovely.
I was the fourth child, and the first three went by, and he put music instruments into their hands, which didn't work until I came along, and mostly broke them all, but at least I was interested in them. It stuck. I mean, the music bug, it just stuck, and I became his one offspring that made music.
And was it drums that you were drawn to immediately, or was it piano or guitar?
Well, I started off on the trombone.
Oh, that's pretty.
There was a piano in the house. I plonked on that. There was a guitar in the house. I plonked on that. But the drums.
Don't all little boys love a drum kit?
Wow, especially, the operative word there being little, because I was a late bloomer. I was a little scrawny little runt of the litter.
Aww.
And one day I banged on a drum. Now I'm an 800-pound silverback motherfucker swinging through the trees. God damn it. I might be a little pipsqueak, but listen to this. Bang, bang, bang.
And drove everybody insane, I would think.
Absolutely.
At that age.
Which is what I've been doing ever since.
Well,
there was another moment, actually. There was actually two moments which set me on this path. One of them was Janet McRoberts, who, when I played my first gig at the American Embassy Beach Club, and we also played the British Embassy Beach Club, I'm there playing, I think, a kink song, and there in front of me is Janet McRoberts, all 50. I'm 12, and she's 15.
Wow.
And for a 12-year-old runt of the litter, a 15-year-old goddess dancing to my groove, that is some empowering stuff that I am, because music does something that no other art does. You know, plays, books, Shakespeare does not usurp motor control of your body. You look at a fancy painting. Rembrandt does not force your hips to move. Only music will actually induce you involuntarily to thrust your pudenda in public in an overt sexual display. Only music does that.
It's trash.
Now, if you are 12 and there is a 15-year-old, and you know what the difference between a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old is, particularly with the girls, that's quite inspiring. But then, so I thought that was it. Okay, the drums, I bang on these drums, it turns me into a bigger entity.
So we have to thank her for letting us have you as one of the greatest drummers ever. So we have to go back and find her and thank her.
Yes. Well, there was another moment too, for which we can thank Wells Cathedral in Somerset. And our school had its Christmas thing at Wells Cathedral. And I was in the band, the school orchestra, but I only played one song, which was dum da 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 dum 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 da da dum dum, whatever it's called, drummer boy or drummer something. And because I was twitchy, nervous, fidgety, I was too noisy. So Mr. Fox, Copeland, go there. And he sent me to the other half of the cathedral. And the other half of the cathedral is an entire cathedral. Wells Cathedral is actually two cathedrals stuck back to back. And so down one end is 1,000 voices of parents, teachers, and students raised in song in these beautiful Christmas carols with a choir and everything and huge organ and everything. The one wing of the cross is the orchestra. The other entire part of the church is just me with all that music going on, flood lit through the stained glass windows from outside, and this music coming through of all these, that fried my little 15-year-old brain. And that left a mark. And then come the moment when I was allowed back into the proceedings, and there I am, and they sing their song, and the echoes are dying away, and the flowers, and the, you know, it's just beautiful. It's just aesthetically pleasing, you know. I'm not very religious, but that's some very potent mojo.
Absolutely.
And it's my moment, and Mr. Fox looks at me, and it's my moment, and I go rum, dun, 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 and right there, I am the helmsman on this mighty ship of beauty and song. And right there, I realize it's not just about Jan McRoberts. This is some deep, deep stuff to which my life is obviously going to be devoted.
I say that's when you knew this is what I'm going to do, right?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, it came and got me. You know, various times I was going to be a journalist in college. I started a magazine. I was a roadie, DJ, everything. But that music just kept pulling me back.
So how did you meet Sting and Andy, and how did the Police form? We've got you up to the church in Wells, so then there must have been...
Well, my brother Miles,
yeah,
and my brother Ian were both industry people. When my brother Miles started a music company, managed bands such as Caravan, Wishbone Ash, Renaissance, and so on, and Climax Blues Band, you know. And my brother Ian, when he came back from Vietnam, got on the phone as an agent. And with that American accent, he was booking, you know, with that American jive talk, he could sell anything. And he was a great eight. So I had two brothers who were in the industry. And as a kid, I was roadieing for Wishbone Ash.
Oh, okay.
And other groups. And so I learned how bands work. And actually, I rose to the lofty heights of tour manager.
Wow.
I tour managed Joan Armatrading, Renaissance, and so on.
So what period is this? Is this like the 60s?
This is mid-70s, early 70s.
Mid-70s, okay.
And at that point, I started to tour manage a band called Curved Air and ended up
being in
as
it.
The drummer in Curved Air, being in the band. So I'm in this prog rock band. I was the last rat to jump aboard the sinking ship. They had all of their hits long before I joined, and I was just a late comer to this glory. But it was a real band with a real record company and a real truck with real roadies and real lights, and now I just had to bang drums instead of carry around a briefcase. And then I think it was either Paul Cook or one of the Sex Pistols used the F-bomb on national TV.
Oh, yeah.
I believe the word known... We'll just use a euphemism and call it fuck, which he said on national TV.
On American TV?
No, British national television.
In Britain.
And that's what caused the punk revolution. The tabloids went berserk.
Oh, my. With
glorious outrage. And thus were the Sex Pistols and punk unleashed upon the world. And
that's brilliant.
It was a whole new scene. And... my epiphany came when my brother, the agent, was throwing a party for one of his clients, Al Stewart, Year of the Cat. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
And so all of his Sophisto friends were there, you know, all dancing suavely in their velvet bell bottoms and so on. And then Sonia and I got back from a gig up in Leeds or Leicester, somewhere like that, at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the party is just raging, and we can hear the bedlam. That we were at a squat in Mayfair at the time, and long story, which is in my book, we can hear the revelry from blocks away in slumbering Mayfair. And we run up the stairs. We get to this penthouse apartment where the bedlam is swinging from the chandeliers. And they're the wildest looking crew in there. And music, like, what the heck's going on here? We were supposed to be dancing suavely to, like, Average White Band. But there was this noise. And these kids and these youngsters had, like, short hair. Not nice long hair like nice people. They had short, spiky hair. And they were wearing suits, which were all misshaped and slit up and messed up. And it was sort of like, you know, every hippie's nightmare is the man. You know, and it was like the man had come back stoned on, high on sniffing glue, and like jumping this vertical dance motion, which later became called pogoing. This wild party. And all of Al Stewart's friends are all outraged by this. All the furniture pushed to the side, and there's this mob heaving, you know, jumping up and down. And meanwhile, my brother Miles and my brother Ian and I, who are everybody in the music industry, is looking for the next big thing. This is clearly it. And we were both inspired by, by the way, I'm in the cusp. I was too young to be a real hippie. I was born in 1952. And so the hippie thing was long spent by the time I came on. It was sort of rancid, old, and we were swirling in the suds on the back of that wave. Here was something fresh, new, and it was going to tear down the walls, and it was happening right before our eyes. And so the next day, I started looking for some musicians of the punk persuasion to start a DIY band. And that was a cool thing about punk. It was very DIY. Curved Air had a record company, roadies, a corporate structure, if you like, mm-hmm. which was all nothing to do with what we're supposed to be here for. But the punk thing was all DIY. You could do it yourself. So I did it myself. I came up with a name. I wrote a manifesto. And I needed it had to be a three-piece band. And either the guitarist or the bass player had to be able to sing. Since I'm breathing too hard, pounding stuff at the back of the stage. So I found this guitarist who was Corsican, hardly spoke English, let alone sing, but he had the right dark glasses and the correct leather jacket and looked and felt the part. And the bass player's got to sing. And usually with bass players, the bass player needs to either have an amp. He either needs to have a truck or a garage for the band to rehearse in, or find a bass player whose father does have a truck. But I'd seen this guy up in Newcastle all on tour with Curved Air playing in this jazz band who could sing and play bass and did have rather a handsome amp. Great, qualified. But there was one more factor, as I'm fond of saying, which was this golden shaft of celestial light descending from the heavens and alighting upon his magnificent brow. This guy just had charisma out to here. I mean, wow, that guy is a walking, talking, singing meal ticket. And so I got his I didn't get his number. A few weeks later, I called up the journalist who had taken us to you know, who is that guy, that bass player, Sting?
Was he called Sting then?
Oh, yeah.
Because he wasn't born Sting, like I wasn't born Twiggy. I've had this conversation with Sting about our ridiculous names.
The only person who calls him Gordon is Trudy.
Oh, does she? That's interesting. I mean, we know them, but not
when he's on the naughty step. Gordon, even I jump when Trudy goes there. I jump.
Oh, okay. No, we just had a mad night years ago. I think Lee, my husband, he was on Broadway doing something. And John Schlesinger, the lovely director, who's not with us anymore,
right.
He had a dinner. And I think Sting was doing Threepenny Opera on Broadway at the same time.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And John Schlesinger invited us after theatre to go to his place. And Sting and I had this mad conversation about our names.
Yes.
And he told me why he was called Sting, and I told him why
something
I was called
Something to do with
Twiggy.
A jumper. Oh, well,
his is a jumper.
I'm sure
mine was to do with my legs.
Right, okay.
So anyway, that was our kind of meeting moment.
Well, I've had to make do with the name my mum gave me. Which is a nice Scottish name.
It's a very good Scottish name. Oh, sorry about the accent. Can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. I used to have all the English accents, by the way.
Did you?
I could do Brum, I could do Newcastle, I could do a couple different versions of London, I could do Oik, I could do Posh because I went to a boarding school. After I've been living in California for 20 years, they all sound like Dick Van Dyke. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the worst Cockney accent ever.
Watch out, mate. What? How about that, and mate? You don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that. All over England, people are listening to your show going, oh, come on, cut it out.
Talking about England, and we haven't mentioned it, are you a tea drinker?
I am.
What is your poison? What do you like?
I am PG Tips or Typhoo. Fiona's on PG, I'm on Typhoo. Except that recently on a trip to India, I discovered masala chai, where they make the tea. Well, they make the tea. Imagine you've got a pot and you put your water in and your tea and the milk and a couple of other spices as well. And you boil the whole thing and you pour it out of the pot already with the milk and sugar and some other weird stuff in there. And it's absolutely intoxicating. It is a cup of tea with a kick. It's been, and I've tried to find the nearest thing I can get to it here in Los Angeles, masala chai. And your Indian and Asian listeners know exactly what I'm talking about. It is a superior form of tea.
I bet you can get it in London because there's so many good Indian restaurants. Yeah. I shall try one next time I go and have my Indian meal. So anyway, so you saw Sting, thought, he's amazing, and he should be in the band. And he's got a great amp.
Yeah, he's got an amp. He's got his own amp.
Wow!
And so I call up the journalist and say, you know, I'm talking about, hey, there's this new thing going on down in London. And, you know, it's really cool. It's pubs are busting. It's called punk. It's little. And the temperature drops 30 degrees, and he wouldn't give me his number. Oh no, you don't. You're not going to destroy our great art band up here in Newcastle and take him down to the pit, the viper's nest of Hades in London. No way, Jose. And so I hung up, kind of disappointed. I walked around the room in tight circles. And then I came up with a much more persuasive argument for Phil Sutcliffe, the journalist, which went along the lines of, give me his fucking number, asshole! But he didn't pick up. His girlfriend did.
Oh, okay.
And, sorry, Phil's not here. Hi, it's Stuart Coben from Curved Air. Curved Air, I love Curved Air, and so does Phil. Is there anything I can do? Yeah, that bass player in Last Exit, you know. Sting, yeah, have you got his telephone? Hang on a tick. Then I can hear her walking away to get Phil's phone book and walking back up, and pretty soon, 432-9187. By the way, you can call that number and get Sting right now if you like. So 1 minute later, that voice is on the other end of the line, that voice with which we are all now so familiar.
Very familiar.
And after my initial thing, which was, look, I'm calling from London, I'm talking about you, yourself, and not your band, two fateful words, keep talking. And now, first of all, that meant that he is a free agent. Cool. Second of all, that's what I had to do for the next 2 years is keep talking and filling, you know, grandiose schemes, convincing certitude. It's all happening. I'm on the phone booking shows and taking care of it. It's all going on. It's all going on. I had to keep talking because for the first 2 years, not only did we not have any of the songs, we didn't have Every Breath You Take. We didn't have Message in a Bottle. We didn't have any of the. We had all my crap.
Who came up with Police?
I had that going in.
Good.
And,
good.
In fact, in my book, I've got the page because I kept all my diaries, all my notes, all the receipts, all the truck, everything. And I've got the page with all the prospective band names.
What's the book called?
The book's called Stuart Copeland's Police Diaries.
Brilliant. Okay.
And it's just those 3 years of starvation where we stuck together. through thin and thinner with my crap songs, which are basically just bass lines with yelling, which was what the punk world demanded. We were a fake punk band. We were carpetbaggers and soon spotted as such by the London critics. So we were going nowhere for a year. And not only did we not have those big songs, because he hadn't started writing, he didn't even know he could write those songs yet.
Wow, that's amazing.
But we didn't have Andy Summers either. We had a guitarist who was really great at playing three chords that I showed him. Henry Padovani had great panache, great sunglasses, great leather jacket, looked the part on stage, you know, completely
the real deal. Did he have a good amp, though?
He did.
I'm glad to hear.
He did. Qualified. But then one day we ran into Andy Summers in the session, because Sting and I, the minute, you know, he did come down to London and called me up from a phone booth downstairs, said, oh, I'm downstairs. And I said, come on up. And we jammed, and it was epic. It was amazing. This complete stranger.
Wow.
And yet we found the pocket. Epic, you know, rare. You know, we raged unto the sky, into the stars. We, you know, we dug deep into the bowels of the earth. We thrust forward like a mighty invading army. We held back with poignance and subtlety. You know, it was just one of those epic jams. And we're looking at each other. I don't know who this guy is, but we're meant for each other. And so we stuck it out for a couple of years without any material, because Henry only knew three chords. And Sting did actually write a couple songs that were not the ones you've heard of, but they were a start with what Henry could play. But then we ran into Andy Summers. And after a day in the studio with Andy, and we're driving home, and Sting's seething with musicality, and he'd sublimated his musical instinct to be in this band of convenience with this loud, fast-talking American guy. But he's seething. He said, we got to get that guy. And I'm humoring him. We're not going to get that guy. He's a triple scale guitarist, legendary. He's played with it. You know, he's not going to, you know, nice thought. And then Sting's on a tirade. And he's going, you know, Henry's a crap guitarist. Yeah, I mean, you're a better guitarist than Henry. And he carries on with a tirade. But I'm thinking, really? Wow. This unexpected accolade, you know, stopped me in my tracks. Wow. You're a better guitarist than Henry, and you're crap. Wow. Really?
Oh, that's so
hysterical. He sure knows how to flatter a guy.
Oh, yeah.
But it turned out that Andy had discovered us. And we finished the album with Mike Howlett, and we played a show. He was in a band called Gong. Who played a bridge in, you know, so in other words, we kept running into Andy by virtue of Mike Howlett.
Okay.
And by the way, 20 years later, Mike Howlett realized, wait a minute, he wakes up in the middle of the night saying, wait a minute, my only solo album, which never got released, my backing band is The Police.
That's hysterical.
So he did call us up, say, hey guys, do you mind if I release that album? I said, hey, look, you paid us 20 quid for the day. It's your record. And so we did. It's called Police Academy, and it's kind of an interesting record, actually.
That's really funny.
So Andy one day calls up Sting, and then I ran into him a couple of days later at Oxford Circus Tube Station, and he pulls me over and says, hey, look, you and that bass player, you've got something, but you need me in the band, and I accept.
Wow. Brilliant.
And I couldn't believe my ears. And I call, you know, I had to kick the wheels a little bit, and I'd say, well, that's fantastic. I can't believe it. We've been talking about the same thing, and we couldn't believe that in a million years you'd ever, you know, wow. But, you know, you realize that we haven't got a record company. I'm the record company. It's me on the phone selling boxes of 25 to record stores in Birmingham, you know. That's the record company. We haven't got management. Once again, you're looking at it. That's me. Road crew? Well, yeah, we do have a road crew. That's you. You on one end of the amp and me on the other end. And that's it. And
that's,
you know, I was afraid he'd quit after 2 weeks and we'd be screwed. But he stuck at it. And it made no sense at all. And years later, I did ask Andy, what were you thinking? This fake punk band that was going nowhere, dead in the water. What were you thinking? And he said, I don't know, mate. Should have stuck with Neil Sedaka.
Brilliant. So what was the first single? Was it
Well, the first single was one that I wrote called Fallout.
Okay.
And on one hand, it didn't get any airplay. Of course, the BBC didn't play it. It disappeared without a trace in one sense. But for us, it was a big hit. I'm on the phone with a Rolodex calling record stores around England saying, I got a punk band. What are they called? Police? That's kind of punky good. Got a picture sleeve? Yep, picture sleeve. Is it hostile? Yep. Is it punk? Yep. Send me a box.
Wow, that's amazing.
Because in the record stores around the land, punks would come in and say, where's the punk? And they'd go over to the punk rack, and there's all these, they never heard them on the radio.
No,
Radio
they,
1 wasn't playing
they
them.
They weren't playing them.
All they had to go on was the sleeve. So not by virtue of the music and the idiotic song that I had written, but by the sleeve that I designed by cutting pictures out of and using Letra Set, we sold a lot of records. And since there was no record company involved, except for me, we actually saw money. We got paid, more than if we'd had a record on
That's
the radio
hysterical.
With a record company. This is cash money.
So when did you switch from the punk thing? Because I never thought of Police as punk.
You're too sophisticated for that. You were not down there at the Roxy Club.
No. The Police band that I know and love is not punk, right? So when did you switch that, and when did the first single come out that, turned it all around for you guys?
Well, when Andy joined, we became the Police that you know.
Okay.
And because he had such musicality, such a wide vocabulary, both with his playing and his instrument, but also harmonically, musically, music theory, he was very, very sophisticated musician. And Sting's ears just lit up, and he started writing these songs, Roxanne, Can't Stand Losing You.
Was Roxanne before Every Breath You Take?
Yes.
Oh,
Every
okay.
Breath You Take was on our last album.
Okay.
Roxanne was on our first album.
Because Roxanne, I think that's probably my first memory of Police, Roxanne. It's still one of my favorite songs. It's brilliant. Absolutely
well, it is
brilliant.
A heck of a song, yeah.
Oh.
And he wrote that wandering the streets of Paris, wandered into the red light district.
Oh, brilliant.
And wrote that song. And he didn't bring it to the song first. He was just, playing it with Andy, and Andy just lit up and said, wow, that's fantastic. We should play it, but it's so not punk. And so they brought it to a rehearsal, and I added a drum beat to it. I made it louder, turned the rhythm back to front, and that's the version that we have now. And so, but it disappeared without a trace.
It didn't, did it?
BBC wouldn't play it. It was about a prostitute.
Oh, God.
Which for us, we turned that into banned. Banned by the BBC. We are that outrageous. They just didn't add us to the play. But then I made another song, which I recorded all the instruments myself, although I'm still denying it, under the name of Clark Kent. And I played all the bass, guitar, drums, and even sang. And now I'm a guy who doesn't even sing in the shower. I am not a singer. But for some reason, Her Majesty, the BBC, added me to the Radio 1 playlist, equals hit. And there we are on Top of the Pops in Masks. And
that's
so there were, and I didn't want to be a solo guy. I'm a band guy.
So
I asked my buddies. So there, our first time, the three blonde heads were on national TV on Top of the Pops was as my Clark Kent backing band.
That's hysterical.
In Masks. Sting was in a gorilla mask. And I very rarely miss an opportunity to remind him of that.
That is so funny.
Although he did get his revenge by writing 20 more hit songs.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was the beginning. And as a result of Clark Kent's success, A&M, the record company, signed the Police properly for an album deal, and the rest is history.
And the rest is history. Because you weren't together that long, right? I know you did a kind of comeback
8 years.
Thing. I know it wasn't that long. But then you also, and we've got to wrap up soon. We could chat for hours, but you'd done loads of film music, haven't you, and TV series. And
you are
a composer of that genre of
fancy
music.
Shit.
Fancy. Didn't you do the music for Wall Street?
Yes, yeah. Among others, and yeah. Equalizer.
Equalizer.
For 20 years. After the Police, for 20 years, I worked, before the mast as a hired gun film composer, who is not even an artist. He's a craftsman serving the director, who is the artist. And,
what do you prefer? Do you prefer composing or do you prefer playing live in a band?
They're almost unrelated.
I'd say they're so different.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, being a composer must be quite lonely, I would think. A bit like being a writer.
Deliciously so. No, for 20 years, I was a film composer, which is basically, I learned all kinds of things. As an employee, I learned way more than I would ever have learned as an artist. An artist goes where their instinct takes them. Yeah. An employee goes where the bosses sent him.
Okay.
And one of the things that I had an involuntary education is in the symphony orchestra. I learned how to use the orchestra as a result of being a film composer. And I quit after 20 years. I've retired from that. I haven't scored a film in 15 years or something. But I still do the same work under the name of opera, which is a very different, it's the same work of using music to tell a story, but there's no Hollywood, there's no hurly-burly, there's no commercial. It's like the business model is to lose money. it's paid for by rich people or by governments or whatever. It's fine arts. And so it's strictly a world of art for art's sake and making something really cool and amazing. And that's what, there's no executives in a corner suite saying, that's not, whatever. It's completely art.
Pay
is not quite as good, but the art is way better and the light. And so that's what I do now. I write opera.
Oh, how wonderful. That's wonderful. How lovely. I didn't know that. I knew you did film music, but I didn't know
you did. Well, my wife has said, Fiona has said, darling, none of our friends like opera. I did drink the Kool-Aid, and I am a fan of opera, but the opera that I write doesn't sound like Puccini.
Oh, okay. Well,
which is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, I wish it did sound like Puccini.
Before we say goodbye, you've got how many children? Four?
Seven.
Six?
I have seven children.
Gosh.
Seven children, five grandchildren, and four grand puppies.
Oh, grand puppies. Oh. Are your grandchildren in California? Are they all over the place?
My seed is spread far and wide.
Okay.
Many in England.
Okay.
I go to London and half the people there are my children. You know, you probably know this, that grandchildren are fantastic.
Oh, my goodness.
As people say, how many have you got?
Between us, Lee's got three with his son and I've got two with my daughter. And they're just, they're the love of my, it's the new love of your lives. What?
If you'd known how much fun the grandkids were going to be, you would have had them first.
That's brilliant. That's a brilliant son. I didn't know.
Another way to put it is grandchildren are the reward for having children.
That's true, actually. That's absolutely true. Well, on that note, I think we'll... I could go on chatting to you for ages. You're brilliant. But Kobe won't speak to me if I go over an hour.
Well, it's so nice to talk to you, Twiggy.
But thank you so much. And you.
Yeah.
It's been an absolute joy. I haven't laughed so much for days. You're brilliant. Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
I'll see you next time a friend of ours has a wedding.
Okay, you're on. I'm still laughing from talking to Stuart. We all know what a brilliant drummer he is and musician and composer, I have met him before and I did know he's very amusing, but I mean, he was hysterical today. On good form, Stuart. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I'm going to go off and have my dinner now. Okay, thanks for listening. Bye. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
Just heard a Stripped Media production.